You are listening to a sermon by Carl Brown, recorded on Sunday, October 2, 2011, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning is a surprise. It's glorious out. I understand via the science of weather prediction that this is the last hurrah. Apparently winter arrives at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Today I'm presenting the first sermon in a series. It's a series because I couldn't fit everything I have to say in 20 minutes or less. It's also a series because I'm very fascinated with exploring this concept and I can't wait to find out what the conclusion is going to be. For the past few months, longer I guess, I have been considering faith, and I found it quite difficult because I lack the tools to actually properly consider faith. The tools being what has happened in the past regarding research and philosophy about faith, what we have done, and what modern investigation has to say about faith. And it's a very, very deep topic when I start thinking about it, because I'm spending a lot of time reading about the 15th century, 14th, 15th century, the Golden Age, the Renaissance. And if there was ever a time that I would like to have lived, it would probably be the 15th century. I mean, it had all of the groundwork happening, and people were discovering the things that had been questions for years, you know, for centuries, through all mankind's life. You know, is the world round? How do you prove that? And well, you know, they were inventing mathematics and geometry, and they could prove it. It was fascinating. And then you go all the way up through faith and what we've done with it and where it's come from, and you get into modern psychology and studies about faith, and it's more than I can handle, certainly more than you would want to listen to in one sermon. This series is about faith, and oddly, the liturgical readings today speak to me about faith. Perhaps this is because I've been thinking about faith so much, and of course, for a man who has a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I have faith that you'll let me speak again on this topic so that it can be a series. To begin with, let's look at today's Bible readings. These are from the lectionary, and that means that I didn't get to choose them. I'm just working with what is given to me from the Revised Common Lectionary. And to make them manageable for discussion, let me heartlessly strip away the biblical prose from today's selections, from what we've read. If we take a look at Exodus, we've just read it, and if I'm going to strip it down to something manageable, I have Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. 1, I am your God, respect me. If you look through 1 to 9, that's pretty much what it's saying. 2, be good to each other. Those commandments are saying, from verse 12 to 17, be good to each other. And 3, I care for you. This is the way I show my love for you, if you look at verses 18 to 20. Matthew 21, the parable of the tenants. One, some renters tried to steal their rented property by murdering the owner's employees and son. Two, they will be brought to justice. Three, because through the years, the Jewish leaders and people have acted like those landowners. Pardon me, like those renters. The promise which Jesus brings will not be given to the Jews. Now, I am, as I said, heartlessly summarizing these because you've probably had sermons just on these verses alone. So I'm kind of crunching things down. But I'm trying to cover the whole lectionary this morning. And Philippians. What is Philippians saying? One, Paul speaking here. I followed all the rituals of my previous religion. Two, my new faith promises resurrection from the dead. Three, I will work hard to do well in my new faith. Okay, now I'm avoiding doing a sermon on these texts, but it's important to understand what they're saying, and so I'm going to do a little expansion on these three points, and then I'll get into faith. Starting with the Ten Commandments here. Number one, I am your God, respect me. Number two, be good to each other. Number three, I care for you. Well, there actually isn't much room for discussion on faith here. Let me explain. Faith in an entity or a concept can only exist as long as that entity or concept cannot be scientifically proven. You can only have faith in something that can't be proven. As soon as you have proof, you can't have faith. You could say, I have faith that the sun will rise this morning. The problem with that statement is the darn thing's right up there. You can't have faith in that because it's been done. Faith doesn't exist once you have proof. Okay, now at that time, from this reading, the Jewish people could see and hear observable proof of God. A pillar of fire by night, unnatural thunder and lightning. They could not doubt the existence of God. He was right there, close by, and they were very scared that he was going to get closer. And that's what the reading tells us. By definition, the Jewish people could not have faith simply because they already had proof. So, that is our first lectionary reading. The Jewish people were born in a situation that had a lack of faith. Matthew 21, the parable of the tenants. One, some renters tried to steal the rented property by murdering the owner's employees and son. Now, this is usually interpreted when you listen to sermons about this passage. This is usually interpreted as a reference to the poor treatment that the prophets often suffered at the hands of the Jewish leaders and peoples throughout the ages. Look at Isaiah, you look at the whole history of how the Jews treated their prophets. It is obviously intended that that's what Jesus was saying here. Two, they will be brought to justice. Apparently, God believes in punishment for evil. Three, because through the years the Jewish leaders and peoples have acted like these renters, the promise which Jesus brings will not be given to the Jews. Okay, the kingdom of God is not for people without faith in God, especially when he is right there in front of them. Okay, why do I say that? Well, I think a case, just as an aside, I think that a case could be made for the Jewish people here. After all, they started off faithless, and they had at least 40 years in the desert with God. The pillar of fire, etc. They had 40 years to practice faithlessness. And remember, you can't have faith when you have proof, which they did. By comparison, Christians only had Jesus in his active ministry for a few years, and after his resurrection, when his godliness was revealed, he was only with Christians for a few days, and only a handful of people saw him. Christians had a much better start at developing faith than the Jews did, because right from the start, we had to believe in what we could not see. We had to have faith right from the start. Okay, moving on to Philippians. 1, I followed all the rituals of my previous religion. Okay, to expand on that, I have to sort of step aside here and talk about, again, some of what I've been doing. As I said, when I'm looking at faith and trying to understand it, I'm reading all sorts of stuff, and some of it is actually modern psychological theory and a term, which I thought was quite interesting and it's proven very useful, is called magical thinking. The term magic here is used in the case where some misguided or psychotic person believes that he can reverse physical laws by some imagined power he calls magic. This is somebody who believes in magic. And when I use that word, I'm using the word as an example of somebody who really believes he can affect the world with magic. According to psychiatric theories of anxiety, relief, and control, people turn to magical beliefs when there exists a sense of uncertainty and danger, and there is little they can do about it. Magic is used to restore a sense of control. Research in this theory indicates that superstitious behavior is invoked more often in high stress situations, especially with people who feel that they have to have some kind of need for control. Magical thinking is the term used when people believe that ritual can bring about the solution to a desire or a problem. Now, in many rituals, the rituals prompt their own use by creating a feeling of insecurity and then proposing themselves as precautions. Okay, let me rephrase that. The ritual not only amplifies a need in the practitioner, it fulfills the need as well. So a clinical model for magical thinking would be obsessive-compulsive rituals. These rituals focus on the details of the action, which removes importance from the original goal. Example here, obsessive-compulsive hand-washing, which is a ritual. It focuses on the preparation, which tap is turned on first, which hand goes over the other first, which direction that hand moves in, how many times that hand rubs the other. And if one step's done wrong in this obsessive-compulsive hand-washing ritual, you got to start all over again to get it right. This is just one example. Personally, I remember seeing one very sad case of a lady at a self-serve restaurant. And she had her food on the tray, but she couldn't pick up the tray and go to her table until everything was perfectly centered. And she spent 5 minutes just nudging her drink, her plate, and getting her napkin straight, and getting her utensils right. The tension was unbearable. And she made a couple of false starts, but she realized the straw wasn't right. She had to get it right. Okay. So, the original goal in this ritual, or obsessive-compulsive hand-washing as an example, was to get the hands clean. But this original goal is now not very important at all. The ritual becomes everything. Now, the point to note here is that magic rituals can continue even though they do not actually provide a solution. even though they don't work, so if you've got a ritual to stop it from raining, even though it doesn't work, that's not important, because the original goal has become less important than the ritual. All right, how does this connect to Philippians 3? Well, the Jews had come to the point where their laws and their rituals had become magical thinking. And that's what Paul is talking about. Circumcised on the eighth day. Everything down to the last detail. Full of detail. Why? The original point's forgotten. The original goals of the laws weren't important anymore, but obsessing upon the laws and the rituals, that was important, more important than worshiping God. Paul has had a revelation. He has discovered that the laws are not important. It is God who is important. Obsessing upon the laws and rituals wasn't important. Faith, not ritual, was what the Lord wanted. The only law God wanted us to follow was love one another. And if that sounds familiar,
we look back up here, the Ten Commandments.
The Jews had lost that. Okay. Second point, my new faith promises resurrection from the dead. This is the crux of Christianity. Have faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will rise again. 3, I will work hard to do well in my new faith. Well, what's to work at? Jesus didn't leave us with a book of rules and laws as thick as Leviticus. He didn't even leave us with 10 commandments. What commandments did Jesus leave us with? Have faith in me and love one another. Love one another. How hard can that be? Okay. So we are left at the end of our liturgical readings today with a demand from God. He demands we place our spiritual energies into faith, not religion, as the Jews did. Of course, we fail at that. The trappings of religion, rituals, holy relics, scripted prayer, grand churches, paid priests, all the pomp and mystery, which kept the common man and woman separated from God for years and centuries, decades, gradually crept into the Christian way. The Reformation tried to bring people back into the two simple commandments that Jesus left us. And while this was good, the trappings of religion kept seducing their way into Christianity. And this is where my fascination comes into play regarding faith and religion. Humans seem to be wired for magical thinking. I can't count the number of times I've seen students in computer science programs, and they're working on a program, and they'll say, "Oh, this time it's going to work. I know it." It's totally counter to any scientific principle. And there they are, in the most scientifically predictable program there could be. And there they are going, "Oh, I've got this little ritual that if I cross my fingers just right, it'll work." And that's the way we're wired. We're all born that way, with that little hope. Religion is seductive. The glorious cathedrals, the robed choirs, magnificent organs, the convenience of buying masses for the dead. The comforting rituals were such suckers for it. So I begin to wonder, if religion is such a grand example of marketing, how does simple faith fit in with that model? And one answer keeps running around in my head at this time. Faith can be likened to a commodity. What's a commodity? You'll hear about it, you hear about the commodities market. A commodity is a produced item for which there is demand, and it is supplied to the market at a specified quality. The market treats the item the same, no matter who produces it. An example could be silver. Doesn't matter who's producing it, doesn't matter where it comes from, doesn't matter where you buy it, doesn't even matter where you go in the world. It's the same price. It's silver. How different could it be? Pork bellies, even something like that, guaranteed same quality, and it's the same price. That's a commodity. The price of the commodity is the same everywhere. The price fluctuates daily depending upon the global supply and demand situation. What would not be a commodity? Okay, well, a product such as furniture could not be a commodity. Characteristics such as design, material, and finish create a different product. A coffee table, for example, from IKEA might be quite different in all of these aspects from a coffee table handmade by a famous craftsman. Both are coffee tables, but the market does not treat them the same. Therefore, they're not a commodity. Now, let me ask a question. Is faith a commodity? Stepping aside here, is faith a commodity? I'd like you to hold that, because you have to think about that for a minute. I'd have to develop something else. Blaise Pascal, 15th century, mathematician. Physicist, inventor, writer, Catholic philosopher. I remember reading about him when I was 14, thinking, fantastic. One guy does all this. Okay. He was a Catholic philosopher, inventor of the mechanical calculator, developed projective geometry, started probability theory, did the groundwork for modern economics. He was born during Galileo's lifetime, 15th century again. It'd be a great time to be alive in the 15th century, as long as you were privileged. Otherwise, not so good. Okay. Pascal's wager is a name given to an argument due to Blaise Pascal for taking steps to believe in God. We find in his argument several important strands of thoughts: the justification of theism, not proof, but justification of theism. In other words, good reasons why there might be a God. Probability theory: there are exactly one in two chances that there is a God. In other words, there either is or there isn't, but that reduces it to numbers, which can be put into calculations, probability theory. And the thesis that belief is a matter of the will, voluntarism. He also uses the concept of infinity, which is a mathematical concept. So it all starts to work together in the great thing of science. It's a great argument by a brilliant man. Blaise Pascal is inviting the atheist who's considering faith to see faith in God as a cost-free choice. Blaise Pascal also was a bit of a gambler. So he used this model throughout many arguments. A cost-free choice that carries a potential reward. He's not arguing that God indeed exists, but only that it might be valuable to assume that that's true. In his Pensées, his thoughts book that was put together after he was dead, Pascal writes, "Who then will blame Christians for not being able to give reasons for their beliefs, since they profess belief in a religion which they cannot explain? They declare, when they expound it to the world, that it is foolishness. And then you complain because they do not prove it. If they proved it, they would not keep their word. It is through their lack of proofs that they show they are not lacking in sense." Let me translate that last part. Faith can only exist as long as belief resists scientific proof. Again, as soon as there's proof, faith, by definition, ceases to exist. That's what he's saying. And let me take 45 seconds to quote from his wager. "God is, or he is not. But to which side shall we incline? Reason can decide nothing. There is an infinite chaos which separates us. A game is being played at the extremity of this infinite distance where heads or tails will turn up. Which will you choose there? Let us see. Since you must choose, Let us see which interests you least. You have two things to lose, the true and the good, and two things to stake, your reason and your will. Your knowledge and your happiness and your nature has two things to shun, error and misery. Your reason is no more shocked in choosing one rather than the other, since you must of necessity choose. But your happiness, let us weigh the gain and the loss in wagering that God is. If you gain, you gain all. If you lose, you lose nothing. Wager then without hesitation that he is. Just to translate that a bit, you can wager for the existence of God or against his existence. If you wager for God and he does exist, you gain all. If you wager for God and he doesn't exist, you lose nothing. If you wager against God and he does not exist, you lose nothing. If he does exist, then you have eternal misery. So wagering for the existence of God is a win, no loss, bet. And that's Pascal's wager. So this brief dipping of our toe into the cold logic of probability theory leaves us with a shivering conclusion. You can't lose if you have faith in God. A little point about faith. I'd like to state that I will ignore the possible argument that person A's faith is somehow better than person B's faith. You either believe in God or you don't. Every believer's faith in God's existence is therefore equal. Now, Pascal goes on, it's a long thing, to say that faith in God becomes, through logical argument, a choice, not a religious experience. Now, that's something. This is important. One can choose to have faith in God. And why is this important? Well, at this point, I can argue that if we choose to have faith, then faith is a thing which we consciously manufacture, not an emotional experience that falls on us unbidden. And faith, if faith is therefore manufactured, and if everybody's faith is equal, can we not say that faith has some of the aspects of a commodity? Some aspects, not all. Not yet. Can the commodity of faith be sold in open markets? That's pretty tough. Like electricity, which is a commodity that cannot be stored, unlike coal, faith cannot be stored. Electricity can, though, be distributed. Can faith be distributed? Can faith be traded? And the most important question regarding any commodity, can you buy something with it? At this point, you might be wondering if I've recently fallen off my bicycle without my helmet. But I'd like to leave you. I always like looking at people's eyes when I use the word. I'd like to leave you with two things to think about until my next installment on faith. To become a member in a church, you must declare your belief in God. Are we therefore using faith as an entry fee to a congregation? The other one is, what value are you getting from your church for your faith? Right now, I'm a little worried you might be thinking that you're not getting top preaching value. Are you getting vaulted ceilings, rich wood paneling, organ recitals, robed choirs, professional pastors to visit the sick for you? And if not, why are you spending your faith here?